Welcome to episode 35 of Frank Reactions, the show where we help you profit from the digital era through better customer experiences, online and off. My name's Tema Frank. I got to give you a warning about today's episode. It is going to challenge some of what your company probably believes, especially if you rely heavily on the Net Promoter Score. My guest is Tim Kiningham, who is the author of a book called The Wallet Allocation Rule, Winning the Battle for Share, and 8 other books on customer experience, loyalty, and satisfaction. He is the Global Chief Strategy Officer and Executive Vice President at Ipsos Loyalty. And I first heard of Tim a few years back when he hit the scene with a very controversial paper in which he argued that the claims made by the Net Promoter Score were just dead wrong. I realize that a lot of you probably do use the Net Promoter Score, and he's not saying it's useless, just that it doesn't tell you what its creators claimed that it tells you. And he believes that he and his colleagues have come up with a much more effective way to use customer experience to predict future growth. And you'll hear all about that in today's interview. Enjoy, and I'll chat with you briefly at the end of it.
Hi, I'm Tim Kiningham. I've been doing customer experience work for over 20 years now. And I started with doing research with a couple of academics, and that led me to love this space because they got into this space because they wanted to change the world, if you will.
I know that feeling.
Yeah, and so they did it because they said that if they realized that they could show managers how to win by doing the right thing, that they would do it. And that was something that really intrigued me, and I wanted to be a part of that. And I've done this for a long time. The one advantage of having started with these academic researchers, it made me really cognizant of the need for high quality research. And sometimes the answers aren't as obvious as people like to make them out to be. And so it taught me to be kind of a bit of a skeptic while going for the same goal to try to make it work. And actually, most of the stuff that I write about is related to things that I couldn't make work. And I was like, why is it that this isn't working? And just started digging in and didn't just say, well, I must have done it wrong. So it's been a long journey, but it's resulted in some good insights, I hope. And I hope that it's helped a number of managers. And I've written several books, and sometimes I've had to dispel things I've written in my first one and my last one,
That takes courage. So let's go back a bit to, I guess, the first time that a lot of people became aware of your work was you criticized what was till then sort of the hallowed hall of customer metrics, the Net Promoter Score. And I have to admit, when I first read Reichel's paper, I thought, wow, this is really exciting. If this is true, this is awesome. You concluded that his results were in fact not correct. So can you talk a little bit about why that is?
Yeah. First of all, I want to be clear that I'm not anti-Net Promoter. I'm anti what the claims of Net Promoter were. And what I mean by that is, we all want happier customers and fewer dissatisfied customers. And so in that sense, I'm there. And when I first saw it, I was like, I was like you. I was like, gee, I hope this works. But like I said, you have to be a little bit of a skeptic because it was hard for me to understand how it could work given that all the metrics he's tracking are highly correlated with one another. So, a recommend intention and a repurchase intention and a satisfaction, all of these kinds of metrics, if they're measured on a similar scale, they're basically measuring the same underlying construct, and that is how do you feel about the brand? And so rarely do they deviate. One should probably be better than another, but the idea that one would be extraordinarily better than another didn't make sense from the work I'd done. And I'd also written a book earlier called The Customer Delight Principle, and I was looking for a simple metric using satisfaction, which should have worked about the same way. And I tried some stuff like that, and I just couldn't make it work. And so I'd already had some prior experience going, yeah, I don't see how this can work. But then again, got to be open. So we really had the hard part with testing that promoter was that nobody had the data. So we did a couple things. I got a friend from the Norwegian School of Management to, they would do the Norwegian Customer Satisfaction Barometer, and they were actually asking a recommend intentions question. And so that got them to be able to get the business results. Unfortunately, I wanted to use the American Customer Satisfaction Index data, but they didn't actually collect that question. So, wasn't able to get so my first line wasn't going to work. Thank goodness the second one did. And then
just before we go on that, then, so the Norwegian study, were they looking at the exact same companies?
No, they weren't. What we did with the exact same that was to see if it was going to work, period. And, if this thing's going to work, it's got to work generalizably.
Sure.
So it didn't work using the Norwegian data. And
what happened with that data? What sort of results did you see? How were they different from what he was getting?
Well, there was no way you could make Net Promoter the single most reliable indicator of a company's ability to grow. Most of the industries, it wasn't even positively associated with growth.
Wow.
But the thing that really hit home was we still wanted to see, how could we use his own data and test to see something. And because I'd started with the American Customer Satisfaction Index data, the one thing I had discovered was that Fred Reichheld had specifically targeted the American Customer Satisfaction Index data. He actually had a chart in one of his presentations it was one of his online webinar presentations that you go on to the Bain site and it would play over and over again. And it would say that a Bain team had looked at the relationship between growth and satisfaction and found that there was none. And he put a 0.0 correlation, and he was apparently the American Customer Satisfaction Index data. So, because it said that, and I knew it was wrong because I had already done some scientific work to show that it linked stock market performance that was published in the Journal of Marketing. So I was like, this can't be right. So I was like, how can I get his data and see if this works? So the nice thing was he had put a bunch of charts in his first book, and that were the first book on Net Promoter called The Ultimate Question. And I realized that we could replicate those charts. But what we did was we just blew them up, scanned them in, and then put them as a background to a graphics package and lined up charts to reproduce them so that now we knew both the X and Y axis for his Net Promoter and his growth data. Okay, so we checked to make sure the fits were the same. So we knew we had a good fit. We knew we had the right data. And then what was nice is for several of the industries that were in the book, they were also tracked by the American Customer Satisfaction Index data. And we knew the years that he looked at. So we just took out the Net Promoter score, we left the same growth number, and put in the American Customer Satisfaction Index number. Now we're comparing apples to apples. And what was funny was the American Customer Satisfaction Index data tended to perform better than the Net Promoter data.
So how could he have said that it had no correlation? Where did that come from?
Somebody gave him some really bad advice and really bad analysis. I'm assuming that he's not doing his own data analysis. That's just an assumption. But, for one of the things that I've learned is you have to be able to go and check and make these calls. And you definitely don't want to say you've looked at something and that has a 0.0 correlation. I mean, nothing has a 0.0 correlation.
Yeah, it's a pretty strong claim.
Yeah, so that was pretty bad.
Did he ever backtrack on that?
They backtracked in the sense that they no longer claim it's linkage to growth is the thing. They've moved to the metric is simple. It's easy to convey, and it helps make cultural change because everybody gets it. And in that sense, he's totally right. It's easy. Everybody gets it. In general, you can't argue that you want to make people happier. The question is this the best way? I'm pretty much measurement agnostic. If he'd come out and actually said that in the beginning in his paper instead of saying everything else sucks and this is awesome, I would have said, hey, that's fine with me. I don't care. It's only when he had to make over-the-top claims. And the problem with these over-the-top claims is when they don't work, and most people realize that that doesn't happen anymore, people start not believing in general the importance of the customer experience. So, it was important to me that scientific integrity in business is as important as it is in any other field. And so I wanted it to be right. And took a lot of slings and arrows in the beginning. And I loved how people would like try to accuse me of bias. I'm like, you can do this yourself. Just go replicate the data. It's public. You know, there's nothing here. We're happy to give you the data that we used, and we can show you that everything is on the up and up. And plus, I'm working with three outstanding academics who are never going to put their reputation on the line in the sense of not going totally for the truth. But but it's part of the job, and it's what you're supposed to do. I mean, I'd like to say that everybody was on board. Everybody wasn't on board. I mean, because usually these things had been sanctioned at a very high level. You know, they came down from the top. You're going to use Net Promoter or whatever. It's coming from the CEO or the president. You know, and then when you go, well, it's fine with me that you use it, but you're not getting what you think out of it. And, well, that people want to come at you. So,
and do you still get that reaction? I mean,
not so much anymore. It was really shocking in 2007 when we discovered it. It's not so shocking in 2015 because, you know, it's really easy. Everybody measured Net Promoter. How many companies are growing like a weed?
yeah, good point. And yet, I still find that almost every company I talk to is using Net Promoter.
First of all, I'm not opposed to them using it as one metric on their dashboard. I'm opposed to, you know, it's just not a magic bullet. Don't take anything as a magic bullet.
So what variables have you found you'd made a comment in one of your papers that using a combination of variables is more effective.
That's true. That's true. That was when we were still looking at a kind of head-on relationship where we're not looking at a relative metric, but strictly looking at the score you track relative to your own performance level. They're bringing in a host of other metrics works. I mean, you can look at repurchase intention and recommend intention with satisfaction. Those all, you know, that still makes a better metric. Or you could look at just doing kind of a fit. How well does this brand fit your needs versus how well does it perform, which is usually kind of a satisfaction measure, or you can even use a recommend intention measure. Those two measures tend to work well together in isolation. But what we've really found is that the big problem isn't the metric. The problem is how we actually analyze and look at this metric. And the problem is we've been doing it all in a vacuum. So you go out and you say, tell me how likely you are to recommend me, and you know, forget about everybody else. And that's really not how people make purchase decisions. And it's not how you think about your brand. You actually think about it relative to the other opportunities you have and the other options you have. And usually, not all categories, but in most categories, people are using more than one brand in the category. And there you need to actually understand what that score represents relative to your competition in terms of your relative rank. The highest score is ranked number one, the second highest score is ranked number two, and all of that. And that turned out to be the big change, because it's about really the rank that you have and the number of brands you use in the category. And there was a kind of a natural law that was being that can use these ranks to explain the share of spending that people allocate.
Okay, so before we move forward, so let's just make sure we've got this straight then. So you're saying if I buy several different types of breakfast cereal, the fact that I say I really like Cheerios doesn't mean that I'm necessarily more likely to buy Cheerios next time around because there are five different ones that I'm equally happy with.
Well, if you're equally happy with all of them, then you're likely just to randomly divide them up, right? So you would expect 20% across all five.
Or you go for the one that's on sale, which is what
exactly. And so that's exactly right. So there, if that's that would be kind of an economic consideration to making that decision. So what ends up happening is if all things are equal, they're all priced exactly the same, and they're on the shelf, and they're easy, and you're aware of all of them, and they're all easy access, then you're just as likely to buy any of them.
Right.
If you feel equally about them. And that's a real problem, because when you use multiple brands And here's the problem with thinking in terms of a strictly net promoter in isolation problem. If you use more than one brand and you're a promoter for the brand, you know, you're a promoter for a brand, there's an 80% likelihood that you're a promoter for one of the competing brands as well.
80%?
Yeah. That's what we're finding in our data over and over again.
Wow. That's amazing.
Yeah.
So you're just an enthusiastic person.
Well, you know, the problem is what people forget is they always talk about detractors, but detractors are a very small number of people because people don't use brands they don't like.
Right.
You don't use a brand you don't like. It's, if you don't like it, it's no longer in your usage set.
Mm-hmm.
Now, for them to get you back, they got to figure out a way to make you like it. But the reality is share of wallet is about the usage of brands you use. If you use multiple brands and at least and you're a promoter for one and a promoter for another, well, you're a parity brand. And then what happens is it comes down to the kinds of things that you talked about that can vary your purchase. It may be convenience or price, you know, and that's a real problem. Or in the case of breakfast cereals, it could be if you have little kids, you know, it's now joint decision making that causes
exactly.
the problem.
Exactly. Yeah.
So. We have to come out and understand where am I winning, where am I losing, and where am I tied. That's the most important thing.
Okay.
Because once we understand that, I understand why people are coming to me because I'm winning on those things, and I understand why they're going to the competition because they're winning on those things.
Okay.
And if I want to change my rank, it's not about doing what I do better. They're already buying me because I'm better at it. It's about figuring out what it's going to take to kind of mitigate the customer's perceived need to use the competition. And so, you know, we think about going to grocery shopping, and it's funny to me because I have yet to hear people talk about how much they love grocery shopping, yet we shop at, on average, like 2.5 stores for groceries. And there's got to be a logical reason. And you know, it's funny, if I talk to my wife, there's a reason she goes to the different stores she does. She knows which store she's buying produce from, which store she's buying staples from, and you go, okay, I get it. Well, if I'm either one of those stores, I'm not going to get more of her business by just offering, I mean, I might get a little more by offering a greater variety of produce or even bigger bulk items of staples. But if I really want to win, I'm going to have some of the items of comparable quality, maybe not match the price all the time, but make it less desirable to get in the car and make another trip for a separate shopping experience. And that's really the part that we've been missing in the customer experience space. And that is, we keep saying, how can I make you like me more about what I already do well? Well, clearly we have to continue to do that. And so, you know, you got to monitor that. You can't have people consistently dissatisfied and failing on that. But from a strategic perspective, if the goal is to grow your share of wallet, you have to address the reasons your customers believe that they have to use that competitor. And sometimes you can't. I mean, if it's a convenience-driven issue, you're probably not going to be building a store there just to appease that customer. But fortunately, that's not the main issue for most. The main issue is that they have specific features that they prefer for one versus the other. An easy example of this that I really like is credit unions, because when we're in our space, we like to talk about how you're going to have high market share if you have high satisfaction.
Mm-hmm.
And that's actually not true. The higher your satisfaction for most businesses, the lower your market share. And the reason for that is you have a smaller customer base that's much more homogeneous, so they're getting exactly what they want from you.
Hmm.
So think Walmart. Walmart always has the lowest customer sat scores. They always have the highest market share. McDonald's, consistently last place, but the number one burger chain.
Mm-hmm.
And it's because they're appealing to a broader audience and they're driven by specific attributes.
Right, and what's driving them is not having a beautiful store or a beautiful fast food joint to go into with friendly staff. What's driving them is price or convenience or...
Exactly, or one-stop shopping or whatever it is, right? And so they figured out what their strong suit is, and they've gone after it. Now, are they losing share? Sure they are, because now you have people that are saying, well, I want more healthy options, all that kind of stuff. And so it's easier to pick them off now. But they're never going to win I mean, if they're looking at the burger chain, the burger chains that are kicking their tail are actually the least healthy ones out there.
Well, you know, that's what I was about to say. McDonald's has found that trying to add healthy options has not really worked for them at all.
Exactly, because it's not their market niche. The places they're losing to are the more high quality burgers, the In-N-Out burgers, the Smash burgers, the Five Guys, mm-hmm. and they offer a very limited menu. Their menu is very focused on their burger, and so they can never have high market share because it's a limited menu.
So it's a question of how you define your market, I guess.
Exactly. Well, if you're thinking in terms of how to grow that share, I mean, it's really think about what your customers' needs are evolving to, and how are you going to minimize that drive to go to a competitor. And they can do it. They definitely can do it. It's just harder because they've already established who they are as a brand. You know, these newer chains can come in and say, you know, I don't have that baggage. I start off with a quality product, a limited menu, and yeah, you know, it's not healthy, but you're not eating here every day. And so that's kind of we're really coming back to the fundamentals of business here. And that is, you know, we still have to think of our brand in a competitive context. And we still have to think about what our customers' needs and to use the kind of Peter Drucker line, you have to know your customers so well that your product serves, you know, sells itself because you've designed it for them.
You need to know your unique value proposition.
Exactly right. Always make sure you understand what your unique value proposition is and how you can address the encroachment of competitors. And so I'm very, very big on the customer experience. I think it's the most important aspect of management competition going forward. But where we're missing is too often it's too inwardly focused only. And with our new work, the wallet allocation rule, and that whole philosophy and how we look at how you can link this to share, it becomes very clear growing share is about addressing the needs of addressing your customers' perceived needs to use the competition and making sure, of course, that you still deliver on your brand promise.
Now, what I find interesting is, see, when I first read the stuff about the Net Promoter Score, my assumption was he was saying that it was predicting future growth. So my thinking was, okay, if they are in fact promoting it, that might predict future growth because they're bringing in new customers. If that were the case, you would think with social media, where it's so much easier for people to promote, that it would have even more of an impact. Although, of course, detractors also have more of an impact, so maybe that neutralizes.
Well, first of all, there's a couple of things to note. It's a recommend intention question, not an actual recommend.
Exactly,
question.
Yeah.
And so there was a great paper by a friend of mine. He's the editor of the Journal of Marketing and a guy by the name of B. Kumar and his colleague Werner Reinhartz, who is a professor in Germany. And they wrote these papers on how you're missing kind of how people grow. But one of the papers that B. Kumar did was also called The Value of Word of Mouth. It was in the Harvard Business Review, and they also did a Journal of Marketing Scientific paper on it. And they showed that the funnel that you go through from saying you'll recommend to actually recommending to the person actually joining the business to that person and actually be a profitable customer is a very steep funnel.
Yeah, I remember reading that.
But I remember there was some research by Godez, and I'm sorry I'm going to get the other name wrong. But anyway, they looked at the impact of people talking about the brand.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out the impact of people talking about the brand is actually more effective for people who aren't loyal to the brand than people who are, because they tend to discount you, apparently, if you're already loyal to the brand. It's only when it's kind of, I'm not expecting to hear that from you, that it has a big impact.
Right.
And we did a big study looking at adoption of a new product to people in a social network based on recommend intention. And recommend intention by itself doesn't predict anything. It only works if it's a new customer and the person is extremely close to you in your social network. And it's still a relatively small bump, but it's a statistically meaningful bump. But in isolation, it means nothing. In fact, it took us a lot of work to find out if there was any relationship at all. So it had to be a relatively new customer talking about the brand to someone that you're very close to.
Does that mean then that companies don't need to worry about being bad-mouthed on social media?
Oh, that's not what I'm saying at all.
Okay.
No. Let's be clear. You definitely want to minimize somebody coming up with a viral bad message.
Yeah.
Right? And you don't want people out there just trashing your brand. The good news for most brands is it's 3-to-1 positive to negative out there for brands. People are, and that's another study I'm working on right now, and it's that way all around the world.
Mm-hmm.
People tend to want to say positive things. What's funny is the guys who are most into your brand, the ones who are actually most identified with your brand, are more likely to give both positive and negative word of mouth about your brand, even though they're your loyal customer.
Well, that makes sense because they want to see you do your best and they want to make it even better. Yeah.
And they're into you. If they're into you, they're going to talk about you both positive and negative. And so it's this double-edged sword of needing a loyal customer who's also going to be, holding your feet to the fire all the time.
Yep. So let's get back to your wallet allocation rule. You've sort of touched on it a little bit, but let's discuss it specifically now. Can you give a kind of concise summary of what that is, and then let's talk about how you measure it?
Okay. The wallet allocation rule was a discovery that we made that showed how to link relative, what we call ranked satisfaction. Again, talking about the brand with the highest rank, score gets a rank of 1 and the second highest of 2 and so forth, and how we could link that to share of wallet. And it turns out all I need to know to have a good prediction of the share that people allocate to the brands they use is to know the rank that they give to the brand and the total number of brands that they actually use. And it predicts with a very high degree of accuracy, which is funny because just knowing the absolute satisfaction score has a terrible, terribly weak relationships. And net promoters, well, all of them have very, very weak relationships to a share of wallet in the absolute. But if you convert these to relative ranks and use this very simple formula that we discovered, it ultimately transforms that into a very strong prediction of share of wallet. And the cool thing about it was, when we talk about is there a single best metric, it turns out it doesn't really matter what metric you're measuring. If you're measuring satisfaction, great. If you're measuring recommend intention, great. Or repurchase intention, or any of those standard metrics that you would use, because they're basically measuring the same construct, and customers tend to divide, have different opinions of the brands they use. It becomes very easy. And so, by the way, a lot of them are tied. So if they are tied, you're both not first or whatever. Let's say you use two brands and you both can't be ranked 1 because you both can't get 100% share of wallet. So you use the average for the ranks that they would have taken if they weren't tied. So in this case, it would be 1 and 2. So the average of 1 and 2 is 1.5. So you're now both 1.5 in terms of the rank.
Okay.
But other than that, I mean, it's a relatively simple transformation, and now you can really strongly link to share of wallet. The thing I like about the ties and forcing the average on those ties is it stops you from being able to say this is good enough, because it moves you from deluding yourself with a high score, thinking everything's great, to realizing that you're a parity brand versus your strongest competitor.
So it sounds then like companies that are currently measuring, let's say, net promoter score really need to add, let's say, 2 other questions. One is how many, what are the other products you use in this category? And the second is how would you rank them?
Well, you don't ask them their rank explicitly. And the reason, what you really want to do is ask them the same kind of question you're doing now, satisfaction or whatever. And the reason that we don't ask explicitly is you need it to be easy for there to be ties. And the way you actually think about things. But if you actually force people to rank, it's kind of like the little kids pick up basketball games where they have to pick 1, 2, 3, and 4, 5. I mean, what happens is there's only 1 or 2 players they really want, right? The rest of them are basically equal. And so, but they're forced now to go from 1 to 5. And so you don't want them to do that. If they have 1 brand they prefer and the rest of them are basically tied, they'll tell you. Or they have 2 brands they prefer, they'll tell you because they'll be equally satisfied with both of them.
Okay, so you would ask essentially a customer satisfaction measurement, whether it's NPS or something else, about each of those brands.
That's exactly right. And then that's it. You can easily convert it to ranks from that point on.
Which is interesting because in consumer products research, they've done that for years. I mean, I remember getting those omnibus surveys at my home back in the days when they mailed surveys and when some of us actually filled them out, where they routinely would list all the competitive brands and get you to say what you thought about each of them.
Exactly right. And it's funny you would say that because this whole kind of relative framework is most used, in the consumer products category. So if you're a big brand in the area, they're all using relative thinking to do brand management now because they're like, yeah, this is the way we think about it. And they may use the wallet allocation rule or they may use some more complicated formula based on the same natural law, but they're all using it. The funny thing is it's the customer experience guys who really need it, and this is the measure that they should be using, are the ones that are slow to adopt.
Now, what about if we move out of consumer packaged goods and think about other industries? So let's say electronics. I buy some of my stuff at Staples, and I buy some of my stuff at Best Buy, and I buy some things at Amazon. How do you compare it? Because the products that I'm buying in each place can be different.
Yeah, that's a harder one, okay? And so if you have a category there where you're really talking about separate products, and so the category isn't, it's not like office supplies. When you put Staples in, you could say, where do you buy office supplies? And you could logically have several stores come in there and not just office supply stores. But if you say electronics, you don't think about those the same way. You think about those as kind of serial monogamy purchases, even if it's like to get a set of headphones or whatever. Here, relative rank still matters, but it matters in a different way because it's a winner-take-all situation. And so what you want to understand, again, is what the attributes were that ultimately, because wherever you bought from is your first choice. There's no question about it.
On that particular occasion for that particular
item. Exactly, for that particular occasion for that product category.
Right.
And so what you want to do is you want to ultimately there go and say, let's, instead of talking about share of wallet, we're talking about serious consideration. Where did you seriously consider buying this product? And if you only considered one place, well, why did you only consider one place?
Right.
But there you look and say, okay, what is it about the other places you seriously considered? What was it you liked about them that they do better than the place you bought from? And what's the thing that was specifically better from the one you bought? And now you're looking at kind of a go, no-go decision. So you're looking share of mind first, in terms of the consideration set, and you can still rank them and say, okay, you're either close or you're not close, right? Because you can get a distance based on a share of mind about if you're first and somebody else is also basically the same, then it's just it's going to come down again to convenience price or something like that. But if one's first and one's clearly second, what is it that was the distinguishing characteristic that caused you to lose the sale and the competitor to win it, or vice versa? So that what is it that's causing people to come to my brand that I have to make sure I do right every time? But now it becomes about attraction for other customers. You're talking to your current customers because again, they're not in the market immediately.
Yep.
So to figure out how you're going to make sure your systems and processes and reward structures are in place to deliver on those attributes that are driving people to your brand.
Okay. Have you done any research at all on comparing online versus offline purchase behavior?
We have done some. And it's funny because people tend to view the two very differently, even if they're buying the same product categories.
Okay.
So it's hard for people to compare a physical retailer to an Amazon, even though they probably buy from both. And that doesn't mean that you can't do it, but the attribute differences are pretty obvious from the very beginning, right? Why do I go to a store? Because, immediacy and all of that, and to be able to touch. And why do I go to Amazon? The convenience, the price, it just comes to my house, right? So, follow the same natural law. This natural law is actually called Zipf's law. Forget the name. It's a Harvard linguist. Z I P F.
Okay.
And, And it turns out it doesn't just work for share of wallet. They've done it for internet usage, sizes of cities, income distribution. It turns out it works in a whole bunch of stuff. Huh. So it was nice because we didn't just the wallet allocation rule, although it's a simplified version of it, you know, it wasn't just one of those things where you went, why does that work? It works because it works in a whole bunch of stuff. It works for market. They can do it for market shares of companies too. But there hasn't been much of a practical implication for it because it was always been really hard for people to use. You know, if you saw the mathematical formula, you go, okay, I'm not going to use that. But once there was a simple way to use it, you know, you can do the wallet allocation rule, you know, if you're a sixth grader. So it makes it very, very applicable for managers. Suddenly, you know, there's a sense of, I understand why it works. And, you know, which comes with just easy math, thank goodness.
So what do you think, and we're running out of time here, but what do you think would be the most effective way for companies to actually get the sort of data that they need to do that wallet allocation rule?
Well, they're going to, you know, they're probably already measuring the customer experience, which is great. And so if they are, they just have to add a few basic questions, some of the things you just talked about. The one thing that I would also want them to do, instead of just asking, you know, about get the high level, what's the share, you also want to get the drivers. And if they use three brands, you don't want to ask them a bunch of different attributes for every brand. What we found is very easy to do is just to kind of put a grid up there that has as the columns the different brands that they use, and then the different attributes you care about as the rows, and then just have them check which brand is best at this or brands are best at this. And so, it comes on the screen. It's very quick. They just click, 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 click. They're done. And now you can figure out, you can do a very easy model to find out where I'm winning, where my competitor's winning, and why, and what that translates to in share of wallet if I can shift some of those competitor best to my best.
That's fascinating. I love this stuff. I think it is really important to get that word out there because I think it gives people a new way to look at things. And certainly until someone manages to critique your work the way you critiqued the NPS, it seems like it's an incredible step forward. So
yeah, we're very serious about the science, and we're not crazy enough to believe that in 20 years somebody won't have come up with a better method. We hope they do, because that's the nature of the beast. Our job is to just keep getting better and better because we want to change the world, right? If you want to change the world, you have to make sure you're delivering to your customer what they really want. And hopefully this gives a new lens and a better and some better insights. Again, the great thing is you don't have to throw away the stuff you're already using. You just are adding to it.
That brings up one more question, actually, which is, let's say, and I could see this happening in a lot of companies, you've got a marketing department that has already done the research on sort of how you compare in terms of share of purchase and in terms of even customer perceptions of rank. Then you've got your customer service folks who've done their customer service research, but potentially with different people. Can you put those two together and still come up with something valuable?
What I would say, well, it's hard to put two surveys together that weren't designed together.
Yeah.
Because you know, then you end up introducing a lot of error. You can come up with kind of a ballpark and figure out how can I relate these things. But I think the real piece, if that's really happening and they're really going and saying we're going for the same goal, you know, in the end,
get your act together.
put these two together.
Yeah.
And let's make sure that we're getting what we really need for managing the customer experience and managing the brand. Sometimes that can't work. I mean, if the brand is doing a lot of ad testing and that sort of stuff, and then that's got to be separate. But if it's really about how they perceive my brand vis-a-vis the competition and how they're dividing spending, basically you just put the brand attributes in that they kind of care about, and those tend to be more higher order trust kind of attributes. And the customer experience attributes tend to be very touch point oriented. You say, okay, we got to make sure that those are in. And sometimes you won't be able to, you may have to alternate who's getting what types of questions in the survey, but I would put them together so that now you have a holistic piece that's benefiting. So the organization is aligned, you know, not the customer experience is aligned with the brand strategy, which is which is what we should be doing anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for your time. I've really enjoyed this, and I look forward to reading more of your work.
Thanks so much. I really appreciate it.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that interview. I know it can be really hard to hear someone say that something that you may have believed to be true is perhaps not true, but I think a lot of what he said makes a lot of sense. I mean, if you think of your own behavior, chances are you do compare brands and buy multiple brands in some product categories. So I think it's really important to give some serious thought to his ideas. It's been a long interview, so I will wrap it up with that. If you have any feedback on the show, I would love to hear it. You can always email me, TEM as in marketing A, at frankreactions.com. You can phone me toll free 1-866-544-9262. You can reach me on Twitter at Tema Frank, and you can find me on LinkedIn or elsewhere. As always, I'll do the standard plea that all us podcasters do, which is if you find this a useful podcast, please do go to iTunes and give it a rating and a review. It does take a couple of minutes of your time, but it means so much to me and so much to other people. If you want to help us change the world, it would be great if more people could hear about this podcast and learn from it. That's all for today. Talk to you next week. Bye.